from New York City. This is John Brown Today, and I'm your host, Louis A. DeCaro, Jr. Alexander Milton Ross, 1832 to 1897, was a distinguished Canadian physician and a specialist in the study of North American animal and plant life. As a youth, he worked as a newspaperman and studied in New York City, earning a degree in medicine at the age of 23. In a colorful and adventurous career, Ross was decorated by European royalty and was renowned in his own nation as an outspoken leader in the medical community as well as a preeminent naturalist. Ross also embraced spiritualism, which in the 19th century was an avant-garde religious movement that often attracted unconventional religious thinkers and socially minded activists, including many abolitionists. Ross is also remembered by many Canadians as a strong abolitionist and a daring activist who used his studies in naturalism as a pretense to assist fugitives escaping from slavery. During the years of the Civil War, Ross served as the vice president of the Anti-Slavery Society in Toronto, Ontario, and was well known among his countrymen as an anti-slavery orator and writer. Later in life, he enjoyed the reputation of one who had smuggled many of the enslaved to freedom in Canada and wrote two memoirs pertaining to his activism. He is undoubtedly best known for his 1875 publication, Recollections and Experiences of an Abolitionist. It was Ross's involvement with the anti-slavery movement that allegedly brought him into contact with John Brown the abolitionist. In his memoir, Ross records meeting with John Brown twice within 2 years of the Harper's Ferry raid in 1859, and he also claimed to have had correspondence from Brown as well. According to Recollections and Experiences, Ross claimed one meeting lasted late into the night and that Brown presented him certain letters from friends in Boston and Philadelphia, which he carefully examined. To round out his story, Ross wrote that not only did he do advance surveillance in Virginia for John Brown, but after the failure of the Harper's Ferry raid, he tried to get Governor Henry Wise of Virginia to permit him to see Brown, but was instead forced to leave the state, whence he returned to Canada and prepared for another Underground Railroad mission. This was the story that Alexander Ross published in two editions over the years, and which eventually helped him to gain access to Brown's contemporaries and even his adult children. In reality, Ross was a complete fake. He may have been a minor league anti-slavery figure in Canada, but his relationship with John Brown and involvement in his story was a complete fraud. In fact, Ross was such a good liar that he was never discovered in his lifetime. Fortunately for history, however, despite the extent of his deception, one man finally interrogated his record, exposing the complete deception of Alexander Milton Ross. That man was the godfather of John Brown scholars, Boyd B. Stutler, who died in 1970. However, no one since Stutler, that is, no one until now, has examined Ross closely, especially since even more documentation has come to light since Stutler was active 70 years ago. So get ready. In this episode, you'll finally get the whole story. In the mid-20th century, Boyd B. Stutler, the foremost documentary scholar of John Brown, became increasingly convinced that the testimony of Ross was not trustworthy. Stutler was an exacting and tireless researcher who had amassed myriads of primary and secondary sources and could analyze with the mind of a historian and sniff out the scent of questionability with the nose of a journalist. In an independent scholarly career that spanned 5 decades, Stutler was not only the most conversant in John Brown literature, but was well-versed in collateral historical and biographical material pertaining to the antebellum and Civil War periods. He was particularly frustrated by the anti-Brown bias that permeated the writing of leading Civil War scholars in the mid-20th century. Naturally, Ross's memoir must have been appealing to Stutler at first. But the more he examined Ross's book, the more he became convinced that Ross could not be trusted. "Too bad," he wrote to the Reverend Clarence Gee, his lifelong colleague, since Ross had long been considered a good witness for the defense. But now, Stutler had become certain that Ross was a false witness. In fact, according to his research, Ross had not only fabricated stories about John Brown, but he also lied about his wartime collaboration with President Abraham Lincoln. Stutler wrote to Gee in 1953 that, quote, "We can safely write Dr. Ross off as one who invented intimacies in order to bask in the refulgent light of reflected glory," end quote. Following Stutler's brilliant lead, then, my own examination of evidence regarding Ross only confirms that this beloved Canadian abolitionist was one of the greatest frauds in North American history. First, it seems peculiar that Ross is largely absent from the major biographical sources on John Brown, whether primary or secondary. Given his repeated claims of having been well acquainted with the abolitionist, his absence from contemporary eyewitness accounts and related correspondence is quite telling. Nothing that survives from the writings of John Brown or his colleagues includes a reference to Alexander Ross. Nothing, that is, except alleged correspondence that Ross presented in his own dubious memoir. So, for instance, when Richard Hinton mistakenly included Ross in his popular 1894 book, John Brown and His Men, the only source he had to use was from Ross himself. Secondly, for one purporting to have been a trusted associate of John Brown, Ross is missing from the Brown family's correspondence until he appears by self-introduction in the 1870s. In fairness, it is not necessary that Brown's sons and daughters would have had correspondence with Ross prior to the Harper's Ferry raid. However, if Ross's claims were true, one would think that John Brown Jr. and Owen Brown, who were both in their father's inner circle, would have had some knowledge of Ross, or at least some knowledge of him in the preparatory phase of the Harper's Ferry raid. In his bogus memoir, Ross represents himself as having been a key figure of interest to John Brown, being sought out by him in 1857-1858, and later being asked by him to take a daring assignment at the crisis hour in 1859. Yet there seems to be nothing about him in any of the several major collections of Brown family correspondence, except that which he himself initiated in the 1870s and afterward. Ross likewise is not mentioned in Brown's memorandum books, now held in the Boston Public Library collection, in which the abolitionist kept a careful record of his correspondence and contacts. As biographers go, it's likewise notable that Oswald Garrison Villard, the grandson of abolitionist William Lloyd Garrison, made no reference to Ross in his monumental biography of John Brown, first published in 1910. Although Villard's interpretation is biased in significant respects, his work undoubtedly was the most well-researched, scholarly effort regarding Brown up to that point. Writing 50 years after John Brown's death, Villard drew from rich sources based almost entirely on the field research of his assistant, Catherine Mayo. The fact that Villard made no reference to Ross in either the text or the notes section of his book is not simply evidence of a lack of historical presence in the John Brown story. A search of Villard's papers at Columbia University revealed that he actually had two significant items on Ross, but he elected not to include them in his work. Not surprisingly, too, researcher Mayo had made thorough notes from the second edition of Ross's Recollections and Experiences of an Abolitionist, 1876. But why did Villard choose to overlook the inspiring account of Ross's interaction with John Brown, as well as his claim to having been a daring undercover abolitionist in the South? Villard likewise made no mention of a letter written by his famous grandfather, abolitionist William Lloyd Garrison, to Ross in 1875, apparently in response to Ross's own request for John Brown materials. Garrison's letter to Ross conveys no sense that he was writing to one who was familiar to John Brown. It seems clear that biographer Villard overlooked Ross altogether because he had quietly determined that the Canadian's memoir was untrustworthy. If the absence of Alexander Ross from prominent historical record is significant, so are his rigorous efforts to correspond with the Brown family in their later years. While Ross seems to have been sincerely interested in befriending the surviving Browns, his motivations also appear to have included a desire to gain personal papers and information, as well as to bolster his self-styled role as John Brown's friend and compatriot. If not the earliest, at least one of the earliest letters between Ross and the Browns was written to John Brown Jr. and Owen Brown on November 15, 1877. In this letter, Ross made no familiar greeting nor any familiar reference by way of introduction. Instead, he enclosed photographic copies of the last written words of John Brown, made for one of the Charlestown jail staff on the day of his hanging in 1859. This is that famous so-called prophecy where Brown predicts that slavery would have to end in widespread bloodshed. In the letter, Ross repeatedly used thy instead of your, apparently to create the favorable impression that he was an anti-slavery Quaker. Ross claimed that he had received the document from a gentleman in Charlestown, West Virginia, which was true. although Ross had clearly obtained it for opportunistic reasons, not only for display, but in order to wile his way into the Brown family's confidence. In the same letter, Ross wrote that he had the good fortune to meet thy father on several occasions and entertain feelings of profound veneration and admiration for his noble character. Ross also mentioned his published memoir, but apologized that he had no copy to send them. But he would send them the new third edition when it was published in the spring of 1878. It is telling that Ross did not expand much more on his alleged association with John Brown in this initial letter to his sons. In his next letter to John Brown, Jr., Ross slightly continued the fraud, writing, quote, I knew your illustrious father and loved and respected him and revere his memory, end quote. Perhaps it seemed strange to John, Jr. that Ross had waited so many years before establishing communication with him, but it seems that Jr. was somewhat credulous anyway, if not eager for attention from outsiders, because he had always enjoyed the greatest share of public attention given to John Brown's family. Still, Ross was as thorough as he was cunning in this ploy. In 1877, he also initiated correspondence with Brown's widow, Mary Brown, who was by then living in California. Ross continued to correspond with John Jr., frequently asking for photographs of the family, replete with endearing references to the interests of his own son, Garibaldi Ross. Meanwhile, Ross made certain to provide the rest of the Browns with photographic copies of their father's last writing, as well as sending off 10 copies of the new edition of his recollections and experiences from Mary Brown and the rest of the family. By elevating their correspondence to an exchange of materials between himself and the Browns, Ross established a strong foothold that would now enable him to entrench himself in the Brown family confidence and exploit them further for primary documents that would in turn be used to lend credence to his own fraudulent story. For instance, by the following May, 1878, Ross had acknowledged the gift of an original John Brown letter, ostensibly sent by John Brown Jr. for Ross's daughter. No doubt a gift that Ross himself had obtained through endearing insinuation. Emboldened by John Brown Jr.'s generosity, Ross then asked for, quote, some little relic or memento of your illustrious father as a favor for his own young son Garibaldi. Sure enough, John Jr., who was generous to the point of foolishness in giving away the family's historical treasures, promised a special John Brown relic to Ross's little son. When the treasure he sought did not come with immediacy, Ross persisted. In October 1878, he again wrote to John Jr., If you can send my little Garibaldi an autographed letter of your father or any memento by him, it will be highly prized and sacredly treasured while he lives. Meanwhile, Ross was enjoying the royalties and reputation resulting from the sales of his fraudulent story. Alexander Ross further was able to exploit religious commonality between himself and John Brown Jr. At the end of December 1878, Jr. had written to Ross, confiding that he and his brother, apparently Jason, were in communication with dead friends in the spirit world. We are spiritualists, Jr. wrote. Ross was delighted to learn this. Perhaps he had refrained at first from informing the Browns that he was also a spiritualist because he assumed they were evangelicals like their late father. In fact, many of the Brown children had begun to leave Christianity while their father was still alive, and the elder sons, especially John Jr. and Jason, seemed to have been easily taken in by the faddish spiritualism of the day. On January 5, 1879, Ross wrote a lengthy letter to John Jr. In this letter, he declared, I feel a bond unites us and makes us brothers indeed. Ross revealed that he had been a spiritualist for 15 years and that he had published his lectures and essays on spiritualism against what he called the orthodox tyrant of Christianity. Junior was probably delighted by this rhetoric since he was happy to dismiss his father's religious convictions just as he had disregarded John Brown's disdain for fraternal secret orders by joining the Masons himself in later years. Not only was Ross now able to wrap himself in the confidence of John Brown Jr., but he found another Brown sibling who was even more credulous and exploited this new connection even more. Ross now also began an extensive communication with Anne Brown Adams, or Annie, who was John Jr.'s younger half-sister and who was 36 years old in 1879 when they began their correspondence. Anne was a teenager at the time of the Harper's Ferry raid and had kept house for her father and the raiders at their Maryland headquarters in 1859. In later years, Anne's writing could be cranky and eccentric, and she claimed to know more about her father's intentions than she probably knew at the time. Yet she remained one of the most valuable historical eyewitnesses ultimately outliving all of John Brown's raiders, and corresponded with Ross over a 16-year period ending in 1895. In her letters to Ross, she often recalled incidents from youth or vented frustrations and shared personal details concerning various players in the John Brown story. To no surprise, Ross seems to have persuaded Anne to write a lengthy, descriptive essay about the Harper's Ferry Raiders, once more allegedly as a favor to his son Garibaldi. If anything, the passing of years and intimate access that Ross had to the Brown family probably tempted him to become even more daring in his claims. In discussing Ross a half century later, Boyd Stutler thus advised his friend Guy that Ross's tales grew taller as he grew older. "He tells about his intimate connection with John Brown," Stutler continued, "yet I'm convinced that he never knew him and had no dealings with the man in the flesh." In historical retrospect, Stutler's judgment has been more than borne out by the evidence. In his day, Stutler apparently did not have access to the Ross Brown correspondence that I have read in the Gilder Lehrman collection here in New York City. But Stutler was absolutely correct in surmising that Ross indeed, quote, "wrangled some letters from the family long after John Brown had passed," end quote. Stutler reasoned that Alexander Ross seems to have had no connection with Brown, not even in terms of manuscripts. Further, Stutler cited an 1865 letter from Ross to George Luther Stearns, one of John Brown's Secret Six supporters. It was written a decade before the publication of his bogus memoir. In the letter, Ross lies about meeting Brown during his secret convention in Chatham, Ontario in 1858, a meeting that Ross definitely did not attend. In his letter, the lying Ross then tried to get some slight memento as a gift for his children. As Stutler observed, as early as 1865, Ross was fishing for an original John Brown document. A decade later, when Ross published his fraudulent recollections and experiences, he claimed that he had at least two different letters that Brown had written to him personally in Brown's own hand. Stutler concluded that Ross was self-condemned by his own 1865 letter to Stearns, and that his own writings exposed him as a monumental liar whose own testimony weighs heavily against his later claims. Without owning any real letter in Brown's hand, Ross at first used a deceitful method of inventing documents for his published memoir, sometimes by plagiarizing other published letters. For instance, he appropriated the transcript of a letter Brown had sent to someone else inviting him to the Chatham Convention. Interestingly, however, the version of Brown's letter that he plagiarized was itself a paraphrase from memory and does not follow the actual letter that Brown had sent out, the actual letter now extant and in a collection. Furthermore, the alleged invitation to Ross from Brown exists nowhere in any archive. In the book, Ross used printed text for the letter and appended an image of Brown's signature. It was a complete fake. Ross fabricated another document for his memoir, claiming that Brown had written to him from Chambersburg, Pennsylvania, 2 weeks before the Harper's Ferry raid. In the counterfeit letter, Ross has Brown telling him that he would begin the raid toward the end of October and wanted his help in the way promised. He signs the letter, "Your friend, John Brown." Although anything Brown wrote from Maryland in 1859 went either unsigned or was signed with the pseudonym Isaac Smith. But since Ross had no copy of letters written by Brown in late 1859, he simply appended a copy of John Brown's own signature, a fraud that seems to have been overlooked, even by the Brown family. The invention of these fabricated published letters from John Brown proved to be the nails in Ross's historical coffin. These letters are nowhere found in any archive, and if he had real letters from John Brown, Ross would not have written to Stearns in 1865 asking for something in John Brown's hand. Certainly, these initial fabrications were essential to Ross's plot to validate himself as a key figure in the John Brown story, a lie that he continued to inflate in later years. Indeed, as late as 1893, Ross deceived biographer Richard Hinton, claiming that John Brown had confided in him at the time of the Harper's Ferry raid. Like so many others, Hinton accepted Ross's story at face value, just as well-meaning Canadians also embraced the Ross deception as a proud fact. In the late 19th and early 20th centuries, and even more recently, a number of noteworthy publications proudly cite Ross as a colleague of John Brown. Now recall that when it came to introducing himself to the Browns in the late 1870s, Ross had sent John Brown Jr. photographic copies of the last written words of his father. In fact, he was quite generous in offering to make duplicates for as many of Brown's children as were living at the time. Stutler points out that the original document resurfaced during the Chicago World's Fair of 1892-93, which included a major John Brown exhibit. At that time, Ross sold the document to another collector, at which point it was revealed they had only recently purchased it from Brown's former guard through the agency of the former jailer in Charlestown. According to Stutler, however, Ross pretended to have owned the document for quite some time. But now it seems that even Stutler did not know the extent of Ross's deceit in the matter. If indeed Ross had only obtained the document shortly before the 1892 World's Fair, it is clear that he had pretended to own it from the 1870s, especially when he sent photographs of the document to the Brown family in 1877. Ross may have borrowed the original, to be sure, but it is more likely that he had gotten a photograph of the document for himself through his correspondence with the jailer and then continued to pursue the document's owner until finally purchasing it in the 1890s. So, in the 1870s, when he faked his way into the Brown family circle, he only had an image of the original document and had made second-generation reproductions to distribute to John Brown Jr. and the other family members. Ross fabricated other documents for his publication, too, including fake written orders from Governor Henry Wise of Virginia, to which he also appended a facsimile signature. And most appalling, Ross manufactured a last letter from John Brown, which Ross dated December 1st, the day before the abolitionist was hanged. To no surprise, these letters are nowhere to be found in any collection, and certainly they've never been documented by any historian or collector. Perhaps this is the most pathetic testimony to Ross's fraudulence and his admiration for John Brown, the epitome of his fantasies as well as the deceptions he wormed into the pages of history. These fake letters also suggest how Ross both plotted and then pored over the many published letters by Brown and then skillfully appropriated the characteristics of Brown's personal correspondence in order to forge his own letters. Lastly, Ross constructed his own memoir somewhat cleverly according to his own studied and reconstructed history of John Brown's activities. In order for him to set himself into the record as John Brown's colleague and collaborator, he cleverly selected the most dramatic and detailed period of the abolitionist's life in the later 1850s. This was when John Brown's life was full of movement, secret meetings, and seemingly endless travel, around 1857, 1858. The fabric of his public career at this time had pockets of dramatic mystery that Ross could exploit, bogus interviews with Brown that could not be easily questioned. But the truth of his duplicity could not remain buried forever, and in the 20th century, Canadians who knew the real Ross whispered their suspicions. Not wanting to play the role of iconoclasts, no doubt, they seemed to have talked among themselves, and a few of the old-timers were overheard calling Alexander Ross a humbug. In correspondence with Boyd Stutler, for instance, Canadian historian Fred Landon acknowledged that Ross took in people very widely. Fortunately, Stutler was unrelenting, and the more he sought, the more the noose of history tightened around the neck of Alexander Milton Ross. In 1953, the chief of the Manuscripts Division of the Library of Congress responded to inquiries made by Stutler about Ross. Apparently, the library had transcripts of both an anti-slavery speech that Ross had given in 1864 and an anti-slavery tract that he had published in 1865. It seemed odd to Stutler that Ross did not mention knowing either John Brown or Abraham Lincoln in either document. The librarian agreed that Ross had proven a hustler. Stutler must have smiled when he read the librarian's own conclusion. Quote, "That, I submit, is like cheating at solitaire," end quote. In truth, had Alexander Ross put his mind to writing a biography of Brown, he might have produced a useful document. Certainly, in the later years of the 19th century, when John Brown's legacy was under attack by post-Reconstruction critics and jealous posthumous rivals, Ross was a good defender of John Brown, and he seems to have known his story well. Instead, Ross first begged and then bought an original John Brown manuscript, only to sell it for a profit, just as he had also profited from publishing three editions of his fake story, a self-glorifying myth that he inflated to shameless proportions over three decades. His was an ambitious and successful program of deceit that probably even deluded Ross himself into thinking his place in history was secure. But if the Browns never knew that Alexander Milton Ross was a fraud and a charlatan who never knew their famous father, at least history exposed him before the world. Yea, verily, Boyd Stutler wrote to his preacher friend Clarence Gee, Alexander Ross was a liar and the truth was not in him. From New York City, this is Louis A. DiCaro, Jr., and this is John Brown Today.